brought to you by Burr and Foreman, broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia. It's time for Results Matter Radio, where we bring you pertinent business information and offer real-life solutions to help drive desired results for you, whatever your business may be. Now, here are your hosts, Elizabeth Gordon and Lee Cantor.
Good morning. I am Elizabeth Gordon, and you're listening to Results Matter. This is a special edition of Autism Speaks, and with me in the studio are a group of experts on the particular topic at hand, and of course, my wonderful co-host, Lee Cantor. What's going on?
It's all good over here.
Great.
I'm in a new seat, so this threw me off.
Yeah, I know. I can't make eye contact with you, so I'm having a hard time doing banter.
Your peripheral vision.
So let's bring our guests on because I can look at them. Today with us in the studio, we've got an expert panel, as I mentioned, Sheila Wagner, Assistant Director of the Emory Autism Center and Program Manager for the Monarch School Age Program, is going to talk with us about autism spectrum disorders and the Emory Autism Center's mission for intervention, education, training, and support. Sheila, welcome.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. And next, we've got Judy Tatro with Nobis Works. Nobis Works, if you're not familiar with it, is a nonprofit organization that helps people with disabilities and other barriers to employment to find meaningful work in the community. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Welcome. Good morning.
I'm glad you could join us. And also, we have Danny Umali.
That's right.
With the Strategic Planning Group. And Danny is going to talk to us about special needs planning and how to leave a family member with special needs in the best possible legal and financial situation. So, Sheila, let's start with you. You have over 30 years of experience in the field of education and intervention with individuals with autism spectrum disorders. Talk about how you've seen the awareness and research evolve over time about autism spectrum disorders.
A lot has changed in the last 30 years. 30 years ago, there were very few people with autism in schools and in the communities. Many parents were told that their child had this disorder, and they were told to put them in an institution and literally forget that they had a child. Unfortunately, sometimes I still hear that from parents, that they've been told that by professionals. But for the most part, that's not obviously not happening anymore. A lot has changed in the way of awareness through training, through professional training and diagnosis. And schools are having students in their classrooms, in the general education classrooms. And that's what I do. I go around the state and work with school systems and do teacher training, teacher workshops. I look at students that are suspected of having an autism spectrum disorder and help the school system complete autism eligibilities. I'm on our diagnostic team at our center as well, so we do in-depth comprehensive evaluations initially for someone suspected of having an ASD. So with the more awareness of having autism and having children and individuals with this disorder in the communities, a lot more is happening than it was 30 years ago. So we tend to see families seeking intervention earlier. We see school systems reaching out for information and training. And we see a lot more progress in students and children with this disorder because of the early intervention that is going on.
Now, when you read about autism, it's a very complex and confusing disorder. Mm-hmm. And certainly has reached an increased incidence level and gotten heightened awareness or public interest throughout the world due to recent data documenting the increased incidence. What is behind seeing such high numbers of children diagnosed with autism spectrum now?
Well, that's the big question, obviously. Many years ago, we used to say 4 in 5 in 10,000. The latest statistics coming out of the CDC released just recently in the last couple of weeks is 1 in 88 in the nation. And in Georgia, it's 1 in 84. I think Utah has 1 in 32. There are the incidence rate obviously has risen. The biggest question is why, and the only answer that can be given at this point is no one really knows. There are probably multiple factors that are coming into play here. Genetics obviously is playing a part, because we do see families that have one child with autism, or two children with autism, or three or four children with autism, or more sometimes. So if they have one child with autism, they have a higher incidence of having a second child with autism. So genetics definitely does play a part in there. But researchers are looking at a number of different areas to try to find out what is going on with autism. The reality is, when you have 1 in 88, we do need to find answers for this.
Now, you mentioned 30 years ago, 30 years ago. Was it called something else 30 years ago? Or, like, why is the time begin 30 years ago?
Well, that's just in my history here and my experience and my 30 years of working
but
here.
But was it always called autism?
It was called autism back in 1976, I believe. It was Leo Cantor. In 1944, Leo Cantor first identified autism. Mm-hmm. And so it has been known since then, but tracking it back in history, they can find incidents where there are individuals that potentially did have the diagnosis.
Right.
So it has always been in our society.
And now just awareness has become so great that more people are aware of it, and now they're diagnosing it, and then they're...
More people are aware of it. The spectrum has also been broadened to include the higher functioning end of this disorder up into the Asperger's area. Mm-hmm. 1994, Asperger's was added to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which meant we were no longer counting autism proper. We were counting all the way up into the Asperger's area. So the spectrum is very broad. So you have a jump in numbers there. But really, when you look at, you know, the numbers everyone is asking around the world, what is going on with autism? And to date, there are no genetic markers for autism. There's no medical test or blood test that you can take that will say, yes, this child has autism. It is diagnosed through looking at the current behaviors of this child and the developmental patterns that the child went through in the early life. So doing a comprehensive evaluation, we have to really pull apart all of the different areas of social, language, and behavior. And those are the three areas that are impacted by the autism world.
Right. Now, So how do you work with the schools if it's that complex of an issue? Like, how are they equipped to handle that?
Well, it is a difficult disability. It is one of the wild cards for the school systems, because you can get trained up on autism on one child in 1 year.
Right.
And then the next year you get another child with the same label that has been
put. Right, but behaviorally could be totally
different. But they're totally different.
Right.
And the whole saying is, if you see or meet one person with autism, you have met one person with autism.
Right.
It is a complex, very confusing disorder. In training school systems, I try to train on the entire spectrum, from the most severe forms, the students that are nonverbal, have severe behaviors, some language, but it may be echoing or echolalia, more repetitive phrases, repetitive behaviors, very little social interaction with peers or adults, all the way up to the Asperger level, that they may have 130, 140 IQ, And they may be doing beautifully on academics, but their social skills are so impaired that they have no friends,
right,
and they're a social isolate. And those individuals need just as much attention and intervention as the individual that has the more severe profiles. So we have to look at the whole spectrum. And that's what I do when I work with school systems.
So what are some of the best practices that are used for children with autism, being that it's so complex and confusing? Are there any that have been identified in terms of
yes,
this is a good way to deal with?
The most research-based practices for intervention is applied behavior analysis, the very intensive practices of teaching a child with autism with the positive social role models. We also know that early intervention is critical in this disorder. So the earlier the child is identified, the more potential that you will see with this child, the more chance this child has of shaping behaviors, of becoming connected to their peers. At our center, we have a whole early childhood program. It's Dr. Gail McGee's whole research area based on ABA, on the incidental teaching model of ABA. And we have four classrooms, and they start very young. We have a toddler classroom. They're about 15 months, anywhere from 13 to 15 months of age. Then there's a 2 to 3 year old class, early preschool. Then there's a preschool class for the 3 and 4 year olds, and then a pre-K lottery class for those 4 and 5 year olds. And in every class, there are 2 typically developing children per child with autism. And so they have these strong models of social language and behavior that they can emulate and be taught to mimic.
Right.
When they get to kindergarten, that's when they fall under my umbrella for the Monarch program. And I go in and talk with teachers and try to get them involved, get their students with autism involved with typical peers. Some of the children can be placed in general education classrooms right away with very little effort. Others need much more support in language and behavior. They may need behavior programming. They most often need speech therapy, many times occupational therapy. So they need supports, sometimes paraprofessionals, sometimes not. Each program, each child's program is designed individually for them because they can be so different from another child with the same disorder.
But you want to kind of mainstream them into just a regular school, though. That's your objective?
Yes, that is my hope for them. It is my mission.
Right.
Because we need to have them be able to function in society.
Just like real world.
Real world events and opportunities. And because they have potential.
Mm-hmm.
It may be hidden by this wall of autism here.
Sure.
But we can break through that wall.
And
many
you've seen
times.
That. You've seen
oh,
that.
I've seen that tremendously.
Right.
Yes.
Now we're talking a lot about the child with autism. Mm-hmm. How does, when you put a child with autism in with the typical student, how does the typical student react to that?
It takes effort from a lot of typical peers as well. So we do a lot of peer training. Typical peers are very savvy. They pick up very quickly that something is different with this child,
mm-hmm.
even if it's not mentioned to them. They recognize right away that this child is different than the other kids. And if they are not informed, if they are not trained, if they are not given some information, and it doesn't even, in the young years, we don't even say this child has autism.
Right.
We talk about everyone having differences and helping one another. As they get older, the typical kids, of course, ask more questions, and then they get more answers.
But do they develop more empathy skills?
Yes. We see the tolerance levels rise dramatically, especially when we get up, when the student with autism can become a self-advocate and say, I have autism. This is difficult for me. Can you help me? then we see the typical peers responding so much better. If that isn't done and the typical peers aren't trained, aren't supervised, yes, we can see bullying going on and teasing. Yes, we do see that. So we do need to prevent that, because students and individuals with this disability, because of their lack of social awareness and understanding, they are very vulnerable to that teasing and bullying. They can be easy targets.
Right.
So we do have to get in. And when you talk about an inclusion program, because that's what I do, is talk and work with school systems on including students into the general setting, it's not just the emphasis on the student with autism. It is on the emphasis of the school, the administrators, the principal, the teachers, and all those typical peers as well.
Right. I would think that it's an opportunity, really, to educate everybody about tolerance and empathy. And everybody would benefit. It's not, you know, the child with autism obviously would benefit by getting the special attention they need. But I think the whole school, it kind of is a way to deal with bullying in kind of a different way.
It is. And it is. Bullying is something, obviously, that schools are tackling.
Right.
Need
it's
to do
in the
a
news.
Lot more.
I mean, there's
in that
movies
area.
Out right now that, that are tackling that.
It does go on.
Right.
And so, yes, these children are our targets for that.
Right.
So by working with those peers, yes, you can reduce that dramatically.
But I would think you would reduce
for
it for everybody, because you know, they are so vulnerable. And
that's
then
right.
Even the, you know, the biggest bully, I would think, would be, you know, see that.
That's right. I've seen that.
Sheila, how long has the Emory Autism Center been operating in Atlanta?
We opened our doors in 1991 as an effort from the Autism Society of America and CADF, which is a private foundation, nonprofit foundation, and the state of Georgia. And they worked together to open our doors in 1991 as a center of excellence in the area of autism spectrum, because at that time there were no centers. There were no what we think of as specialists in this area of autism spectrum. And so they worked very hard to get the center established. And we have many opportunities for families to come in for some services. We have an early childhood program. We have the school age program. We have the adult program. We have the autism assessment, where we look at the child for the disorder and do evaluations. We also have medication evaluation clinic, where we have psychiatrists. The Emory Autism Center is at Emory University. We're within the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. So we are under the umbrella of Emory, and they support us as well. We have a big, beautiful building that CADF bought us on Shoup Court, which is on the Claremont campus of Emory University, on that side of the campus. And families can come and get information. We can work with families on finding resources, on training families to work better with their child, understand this disorder better. We do, of course, work a lot with the school system, so that whole school age, K through 12, is covered by my program, the Monarch program. And then we have the whole adult program that works with young adults and adults all the way up to middle age and aged on the issues that are surrounding that ages. And in all of our programs, we're very careful to include typical peers, because we want to educate, but we also want the individuals with autism to have the experience of having strong social and language models to work with, to have recreational activities. Our adult program has gone out to restaurants and movies. They've gone to Braves games. And they've gone down to the airport and done a whole desensitization program for how you go through the process of taking a flight with your family members. So we have volunteers that have worked with our adult program as well. So we have a lot going on at the Autism Center.
Certainly, sounds like it. Where mm-hmm. can people find out more information if they're interested in participating in all of this stuff that's happening?
We have a website through Emory University. Probably the easiest thing is to go to emory.edu and then do a search for Emory Autism Center, and it'll come up. The link will come up. Our phone number is 404-727-8350. And families and agencies that are wanting more information can give us a call, and we'd be glad to help them, see what we can do to help them at whatever their need is and at whatever that age of that individual with autism is.
Terrific. Thank you, Sheila You're Wagner, welcome. Assistant Director of the Emory Autism Center. I'm going to turn now to Judy Tatro with Novus Works. Novus Works serves youth and adults with all types of disabilities. And I'm seeing that the population along the autism spectrum is growing. Sounds like you guys have started to recognize that you can provide some additional support services specific to this particular need. Talk about this, how you got into this line of work. Judy, let's start kind of at the beginning and with your story here.
I actually came into the business through a friend. She had seen a lot of things I had done in the past and thought I would be a good addition. I came in as a job coach, working one-on-one with individuals, getting them trained with the resumes, the applications, going through the process of being hired, finding a job that fit them, not just a job, but a job that would fit their needs and their special behaviors.
So again, it's important that this is very customized,
exactly.
The programming and the counseling, the coaching.
Right, exactly. And so you have to be one-on-one with each individual. One of the things that the Novus Works does that a lot of centers don't do is we spend a lot of one-on-one time even after they're hired. We will stay in the business with them, training well alongside them, and give them natural supports, get them used to the people they'll be working with. Making sure that they understand what they're going to be dealing with. It seems to make their employment retention a lot higher than the companies that just go in, get them the job, and then kind of leave.
Do the companies you work with, are they typically one-off jobs, or are these companies kind of committed to this cause and are working to create opportunities for these people just on a regular basis?
We have a lot that are doing it on a regular basis. Kroger, Wellstar, a lot of different companies. Nally Lexus has just started Cafe Blends, which is for autism only. Mm-hmm. And they have three new individuals that just started at their Roswell location. And they are doing amazing job. I mean, the kids start off kind of slow and not, you know, with their personal skills, but they have really...
Right. What are some of the jobs?
Our kids have done everything from working at, like I said, Kroger's or Publix's, to working, I had one kid that worked in an airplane company that did refurbishing for airplane parts. So he did sanding. He did all kinds of different stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's no limit as to what they can do. It's just finding the fit that fits what
right.
they enjoy.
Now, from the company standpoint, do you have any suggestions? Like what kind of mindset does the company have in order to work with these kids?
They have to understand that it's their abilities they're looking at, not the disability.
Right.
And if you can get used to working with that ability, that child will come, or that adult will come around
right.
and work in the pattern with what they want. And they will find that that person is hardly ever absent. They're always there early. They follow every instruction you tell them to because they're so structured. That's what they're used to.
Right.
So they make the best employees of anyone I've ever seen.
Yeah, seriously. I don't know too many.
It's true. They are. And it's funny to hear a manager come back and say that to you after they've been there for a while.
Right.
And say, oh, can you just bring me three more just like them? And I'm like, sure. So it is a lot of fun to see the kids succeed.
What's some of the other feedback that you get from the employers after having hired somebody from Novus Works?
A lot, like I said, is the training, that they are really surprised at how much on-site training we do. With Kroger, we have a training facility on Johnson's Ferry Road where we will take 6 to 8 people at a time, and they'll go through a 6 to 8 week training period. So when they come out of that program, they're already ready to go to work. They already know all the routines. They already know everything. And a lot of the stores are ready to take them right then. It also helps them be able to transition to, like, Publix or Walmart or whatever it may be, because they've already been accustomed to that situation.
So what does the training cover? I mean, why is somebody that has gone through a program like this and gotten trained different than, or, you know, more work ready than maybe someone who hasn't gone through that program?
Well, it's kind of like what Sherry said. It's the desensitization. I mean, they really learn to be comfortable in that area. They're not scared of the situation of being left alone after you leave. They know what to expect, and it really helps them be able to transition without us. We also put into place a lot of natural supports at that facility, wherever they're going to be, which is something else that she was discussing, is giving them the support of their, okay, you can go to this person when you're working if you're having an issue, right, and they will help you. So we're kind of training the employees and the management there also to be ready for these people to come in and work.
Now, do you have any stories you can share, maybe of somebody you put somewhere and kind of the result that happened?
My favorite one to tell, and I should have brought my picture to show y'all, is I had a nice kid. He was on the autism spectrum, and he went through our Kroger training program. And when it was done, they didn't have any openings at the time. Well, I went back to that store 32 times. And they finally hired him. And after he was there for about a month, the manager called me and said, I don't know why I waited so long to hire him. He is just a wonderful worker. He makes mm-hmm. the employees laugh. People come in, they know him. You know, it's just an awesome thing to see.
Right.
And it really changed that manager's opinion completely.
So he was more open to it in the future?
Oh, yes. Because, and that's a, you know, when you're dealing with these companies, they're open to having the employees. But you have different management at different stores that may not be as open as the right. company itself is. And so we have to really...
So every store is in its own adventure, huh?
Oh, yes, it is. It is a big adventure. But we have seen so many longevity with employees. It's not funny. We've had guys that stayed at Kroger 17 to 20 years.
Wow.
I mean, that's not a teenager you hired to bag is going to be gone in right. a couple months or want to move up or whatever. A person that has a disability is usually just happy to be there.
Right.
So, and they like that routine of that one job. So right. they'll stay there usually for a very long period of time.
Right.
So there's a lot less training in that.
So how do people find out about Nobis Works as, you know, whether they're parents with a child with a disability or other people in the
right,
community?
Because what, Sheila, you can speak of this. Once they're out of high school, now you mm-hmm. still have, there has to be a next step, right?
That's right. There does have to be a next step. And it is something society has to be looking at because of the statistics.
Right.
We have so many individuals with
right.
this
especially
disorder.
When, like you said, when one yes. in 88, one in 84.
That's right.
The number's only getting larger.
It's only getting larger.
So that's where Nobis is really providing a tremendous service.
Yeah, we start usually the summer as they're getting ready for their senior year, sometimes their junior year. We'll go ahead and they do a summer program with us and start getting used to the whole routine of it for the transition
right.
period. We also deal a lot with the Department of Labor and their vocational department, getting referrals back to us with parents that don't know
right.
and have not been taught about the services we can provide. We also do a lot of advertising, as you can probably imagine, with our different events to let people know that this is what we do.
And what are some of the events?
Yeah, do you have some fundraising events coming up?
So. The next one coming up should be the Galaxy of Stars. We do it every year. And it gives the community a chance to see businesses that have worked with us throughout the year, and clients that have actually succeeded in their positions. They've been hired. Programs that are made specifically for people with disabilities. We reward them for, you know, having the inventiveness to go out there and do it. And so it's a very nice luncheon. Everybody comes, the kids get dressed up and are all excited about being able to be there. So it's a wonderful event. And then Tommy Nobis does a golf tournament every year also. It's a big event for us.
Now, you mentioned the new program with Nally Lexus and their Asbury Automotive Group. What were they looking to achieve when they, you know, decided
right.
to partner
with you?
Can you
talk about how that relationship kind of happened?
There was a manager at one of their dealerships that had seen some articles on the autism thing, the spectrum of it, and they were interested in starting something. They had heard programs that did this, and they thought, well, that would work well inside their dealerships, you know, coffee for the employees and coffee for clients sitting around waiting.
Oh, and yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah, so they started up one program at another facility, and it worked really well, and the customers were very supportive of it. And so they thought, well, we'll expand it and see. And Nally, Alexis, and Roswell put together this program for kids that's called Cafe Blends. And three young gentlemen go in there, and they make coffee. They know how to make all the different kinds of falafels or whatever they are, lattes. And I mean, it's amazing how much they can remember all that stuff to right. do. But yet people think they have a disability that they can't work. And it's just amazing to see them.
So so they actually created like a little cafe within the dealership?
Yeah, it's a little cafe inside the dealership with a little coffee bar.
And then these kids, or now the adults, are now running that business
yes.
for
three,
them.
Yeah, three kids, or three adults are running it. One of the dads told us that he could not believe the change in 1 month. That did not happen over 12 years in school.
Right.
But in 1 month of working in the public, how much his personality had changed.
Right.
So it's a big jump for us to see that happening.
Right. What do you think of that, Sheila?
I think it's fantastic. In fact, I work with a high school that had a similar setup with a coffee bar.
Right.
And their students did it within the school.
Uh-huh.
And it gave them that kind of transition skills so that they can go out and go in and possibly have that same kind of thing happening out in their community as well.
So then when you have somebody kind of graduating to this job, it's helping the company, it's helping the person.
Absolutely.
How does it impact the family of that person, that kid who's now has this job? How do they?
Oh, families love it if their child has, just like
right.
any family, that has
But the
has
sense
any
of pride,
child.
I would imagine,
it's
just
wonderful
phenomenal.
To see that, yes.
Yeah.
Very happy that their child has the possibility and the opportunity to have that kind of a job.
Now, because of the wide range on the spectrum, do some of these kids turn to adults who have to stay at home? Or
yes.
Ultimately, do you want them to be living alone? Or is it a whole range of things?
It certainly
happen?
Is a range. We have
right.
some that are still living at home. Many of them are living at home.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the families want them to remain in the home.
Right.
Sometimes the individual with the disorder themselves want to be out in sort of an assisted living
right.
kind of situation. They want to be out among their age
right.
range at that age. Mm-hmm. Some are in dorms at schools. Some have their own apartments. It really depends on how much support they're
right.
going to be needing.
But when there's jobs like Judy's describing, when you have those kind of opportunities, that gives them a lot more choices,
it
I would imagine.
It certainly does. Yes.
Yes, it does. It gives them a wider variety, and the parents learn that, you know, they are eventually will not be there with them, and so they will need to be able to do things on their own.
Right. So it's probably kind of peace of mind for the mm-hmm. parent.
Yeah, a little bit of a relief, peace of mind, and seeing them child grow in that area
yeah.
is definitely right. something that opens the eyes of
right.
parents.
You must have these rewarding stories happen like on a daily basis over at Nobis, huh?
Oh, yeah, we do. We have
a lot of tears are shed in that place, I bet.
Oh, yes, there is. we have one gentleman that's blind that comes from South Atlanta to Marietta. Takes 3 buses and 2 trains to get to us every day and has worked for us for 9 years.
Wow.
So you tell me that people with so-called disabilities can't do yeah. it, I won't listen.
Right.
These kinds
incredible.
Of stories go yeah. on all the time.
Yeah.
We hear that a lot. That's
yeah.
neat.
So, Judy, if employers want to tap into some of the abilities of people with disabilities, or if families are interested in finding out more about Nobis Works and what you guys do, where can they contact you and find out more information?
We are at www.nobisworks.org, and it's NOBIS for Nobis. Or you can call the office at 770-427-9000. And they will help you out there.
Terrific. Now I want to bring Danny Umali into the conversation with Strategic Planning Group. Danny, you specialize in doing planning for families and people with special needs, correct?
Yes, that's right.
How did you get into that?
Well, my My wife worked at a special needs school in the south side of Atlanta in Fayetteville, the Joseph Sam School, in the speech department. And I got into financial services a little over 3 years ago. And one thing they do a really good job for us is they teach us a lot about estate planning. And we almost sound like lawyers sometimes when we talk to our clients. And an area of estate planning that was always mentioned but never really focused on was the special needs trust. And it's the fault with our industry. I mean, financial advisors, they're chasing wealthy people on the golf course. They're, you know, no one's beelining it to the special needs trust. So I asked around, and I educated myself, and I talked to some attorneys in the Atlanta area that specialize this. And I approached my wife, and I asked her about this special needs trust, working in the special needs field for 7 years, and she'd never heard of it.
Wow.
Really?
So I talked to some of the teachers, some of the parents, and guess what? They've never heard of this. And what I learned very quickly was that this was a very important area of planning, and that was largely unknown with a community of people that were largely underserved. So one family at a time, I started working with them on this type of planning. And
can you kind of describe what it is and you know, kind of describe it to educate some people about it?
Sure. Well, that's why I'm here. So special needs planning, to borrow the words of another attorney that I worked with, it's basically leaving your family member with special needs in the best possible legal and financial situation. And a lot of people will think, well, this is planning for after I'm gone as a parent. And that is very important. It's a valid question for a family of typical children. What happens to my kids after I'm gone?
Sure.
In those typical family settings, I think they have a reasonable expectation that at some point in time, their children will get a job and be able to take care of themselves. For families with special needs, the question's a little more complicated. And there are other considerations that you need to take into account before that happens. There's guardianship, powers of attorney, just a lot of issues that should be considered.
So in addition to the physical and psychological complexities here, we've got legal and financial complexities when you look at the planning situation.
Well, to mirror some of the things that Sheila said, we're talking about inclusion. At some point in time, this family member with special needs is going to have to interact in the real world. And the laws, the federal laws in particular, the laws in the state of Georgia are not particularly special needs friendly. When you reach the age of 18, as far as the state of Georgia is concerned, you're an adult with all the rights and decision-making abilities as an adult, unless you make the proper arrangements. Can someone with special needs be trusted to go into a legal contract? State of Georgia says yes, unless you plan for that or make some legal preparations.
So you really need to head off some of the potential risks that take place before that 18th birthday.
That's right. For example, there was a family where a child got a hold of the parent's credit card and charged an entire semester's tuition because they wanted to go to college. So the parent called the college and said, this is just a misunderstanding because my child really can't be making decisions like that. And, well, child was 18 years old. The parent didn't have legal guardianship of the child. And according to the letter of the law, this child was an adult that made an adult decision. And there was no refund on the tuition. So practical matters really have to be addressed.
And it's kind of counterintuitive, isn't it? When you have a typical child, you're trying to save money and you're putting away for college, you're doing all these things. But when you have a kid with special needs, isn't there certain things that you don't want them to have, like chunks of money like that, because that can affect their resources that are available to them?
Yes.
The immediate need with a strategy like this concerns families where SSI and Medicaid's in the picture. These are very, very important benefits that these families count on. And I didn't make this up. This is just the law. If an individual with more than $2,000 worth of countable assets, they no longer qualify for those benefits.
$2,000.
That's right. According to the law, you're no longer poor enough to qualify for those benefits if you have $2,000 in countable assets. So all a parent has to do is not plan. If something happens to them and they pass away, the estate laws take over, the probate laws take over, and if a child automatically inherits a share of the parent's estate,
right.
They could potentially lose
their benefits. All their benefits.
That's right.
Now, but how does that tie in, Judy, with them getting a job and things like that? How do you kind of walk those lines?
That's things can also be potentially complicated, because if an individual with special needs earns a little too much income,
right,
it could impact those benefits, which is why they spend down their income. They have to really monitor what they're making. And there are legal strategies and trust strategies that
you
can employ.
So you can have a job and also kind of get the benefit.
Yes. It is. There are ways of doing that.
Yes, we work a lot with the Shepherd Center here in Atlanta. They have two people there that will sit down and can tell you how much you can make exactly to the hour without benefits being interrupted. They will show you the tax stuff that you have to do with it.
Right.
We definitely watch that very closely, because we do not want them to lose their benefits.
Right.
So we will make sure that whatever their hourly pay is, we will divide it out
to make sure. Yeah, it seems like, you know, Elizabeth, that this is kind of a situation where you need a whole team of kind of trusted advisors to help you manage this.
Right.
This is not something that's very intuitive, and you just can't wing this.
That's right.
You need to have, like you were saying, you need to have a lawyer, you got to have a financial person, you got to have experts dealing with the behavior element of this. It's just a very complicated situation.
And I couldn't agree with you more. And the one thing that I really have to think about is, you have to understand that you're working with a family, and they've got all these experts in the school system. They're doctors, they're psychologists. They're all telling them what to do. Okay, and you have to remember that there's a lot of attorney aversion out there.
Right.
There's a lot of aversion towards financial professionals, and the last thing they want are these people coming in, telling them what to do.
Sure.
So whenever I work with these families, I always have to be mindful of that and make sure that I'm really speaking towards their particular goals.
Right.
Because there's no blanket strategy that works for every family. You really have to find out what their goals are and really come in with a real collaborative attitude and get them to be open for this type of planning.
Right, but it seems to me that you just can't not plan. You have to be planning almost as soon as you recognize that there's an issue, that this isn't a can you can kick down the road, because you can make a misstep that can cost you dearly as the years go on.
I agree. But remember, these families have typical family problems. They've got to make sure dinner's cooked on time.
Right.
They've got rising gas prices. They've got braces. So there's a lot of noise out there. But I find that when they sit down with an expert, and when they start addressing these issues from a legal standpoint and from a financial standpoint, everything else tends to fall into place.
So even though you think you don't have time, once you make the time for it, you actually feel like there's a burden then lifted.
The analogy I like to use is, take the busiest CEO in the country. If he goes into work and he's got a sharp pain in his chest, he's going to make the time and he's going to beeline it to his cardiologist. The thing is that a family without a plan, they have a sharp pain in their chest. They just don't know it. And they have to make the time. I've had people just cancel appointments with me because they had a hair appointment, or you hear all kinds of things. But you also have to take into account the subject matter. Who really wants to think about this? Who wants to think about and start having these conversations about what would happen after I'm gone? and it's a challenge.
Right. I mean, drafting a will is never the most
right. No one wants to have that
thing.
In the best.
Hey, what
case.
Do you want to do this weekend? Right. Let's yes. come up with
let's
a plan
about,
when we
let's
die.
Let's talk about our death. Yeah. Where do I sign up for that?
But I mean, and also, you know, you tend to think when people are creating a trust, I think these are for really wealthy people, and I wouldn't even think that that was something that would be applicable until you're in a certain
Absolutely.
Income bracket. I mean, what are the types of families that you're working with?
You bring up a great point. When people hear the word trust, they automatically have these misconceptions. And I'll tell you the story about this school teacher that I worked with. She absolutely didn't think she had any business talking to a financial advisor or setting up a trust. Pulling in $24,000 a year, single mom, one typical daughter, and two sons that were on the high end of the autism spectrum. No family that she could trust, laid awake at night, wondering what would happen if anything happened to her. So she worked with my wife, and my wife talked her into just having just a 15-minute conversation to get educated. Now, I won't bore you on all the details, but what I want to tell you is the plan that she has in place now if anything should happen to her. If something happened to her today, $1 million tax-free would flow into a special needs trust. And her daughter would be taken care of, and her two boys would be taken care of. So how does a teacher on that kind of salary get $1 million? I mean, she never would have guessed it, and she's a lot better off having spent 15 minutes with me to get that process started. It can be done.
That's huge. Well, there are a lot of costs involved and things to think about. I mean, where's all this money supposed to come from for families that have...
Well, I say this not as a life insurance salesperson. Any financial services professional that works in this space or any attorney that specializes in this will tell you that life insurance is the best vehicle to fund this type of trust. And when I mention that, a lot of light bulbs come off. What's the most efficient financial way to produce the most amount of dollars after you're gone? And it's life insurance. Now, there are some drawbacks to life insurance. Do you qualify for life insurance? You know, that's why early intervention is key, because it's easier to get life insurance when
you're younger, as a
parent. Yeah. But there are other strategies, but, you know, life insurance tends to be the most popular funding vehicle for these types of trusts.
And, I mean, so who should be involved in having these kinds of financial planning conversations?
Well, any family that's worried about what would happen to their kids if they're not around, because there's a lot of different plans that you can have. There are attorneys and there are planners out there that will tell you just legally disinherit the child. That way, it's impossible for them to inherit everything. And it actually sounds like a pretty slick legal maneuver.
Like, oh, that's a workaround.
That's right. Just take your money or anything, any assets, and leave it to a trusted family member or to a friend. And at first blush, it sounds like a great plan.
Sounds kind of dangerous.
The problem is that if you did leave that money to a trusted friend or family member, what if that family member was on the receiving end of a lawsuit? Where would that money go?
Or, right, because now it's an asset of that person.
That's right.
Right.
Or divorce happens.
Right.
Where would half of the money go in that situation? So a special needs trust really does a good job of,
right, it seems targeted to solving the problem that you have.
That's exactly right, because the federal government created the law, the $2,000 rule,
right,
and they said, whoops, well, we need to create another law
right.
that can help these families counteract that law. So it's if you want to get to the legal term, the actual legal term is a supplemental needs trust.
It's called the Supplemental Needs Trust?
Because it's designed to supplement the benefits that Medicaid covers. So uh-huh. it can't pay for the things that Medicaid pays for, but it can pay for the other things, transportation, vacations, vocations, assistance, other types of things that really improve the quality of life for that individual.
So while we're talking about how essential planning is in the equation, I understand that the large majority of families with special needs actually don't plan.
You know,
what's your theory on this?
Well,
is that true?
I think yes. It is, because
really,
I thought it was an education issue.
Right.
Because a lot of families just didn't know about it.
It's a denial issue?
Here's what I know. If I'm in a room and I'm presenting to 10 families that need my help, I'll end up talking to three of them, and actually one of them will move forward. And I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that it's a future need. I don't really need to worry about this right now. And it's something I want to put off, and I just feel really uncomfortable with. And here's the thing. You have to have the whole family on board with this plan.
Right.
I can't even begin to count the number of moms or dads that I talk to that are on board, and then the other spouse comes into the picture and puts on the brakes.
Wow.
And it's unfortunate, but you really have to have the entire family involved for it to work properly. Because
optimally, when at what age would the child be? Like, what's the best window to deal with it?
Earlier the better, but you have to understand that.
But isn't there at some point of where you can't deal with it anymore?
Well, parents get motivated around the time when their friends and people in the school systems are talking about guardianship, because when they become an adult, that's when
it's a whole new ball game, right?
That's right. That's when they really start to feel the pinch, and that's when they reach out to me.
And sometimes it's too late at that point, or it costs way more at that point?
No, I wouldn't say it's too late. I wouldn't say it's too late. That's just the time when I have a captive audience. and I've met families where it was too late, and it's just it's all about early intervention. I mean, you have to start early.
So what would be an example of too late? What happens that makes it too late?
Well, there was a family, business owner, single dad, owned two businesses. And he had a son with a number of issues, really couldn't take care of himself, was on SSI and Medicaid. His father passed away without a will. And in the probate laws of Georgia, he inherited everything. And not only was the business a mess, not only was he did he inherit a couple of businesses that he would not be able to run, he lost his benefits. And now you have the values of the businesses that he would literally have to spend down and get rid of before he could be eligible for those benefits again.
But does he even know that this is happening?
Well, that's the thing. He doesn't. In situations like those, the courts usually appoint some type of guardian to sift through those issues. And the problem with that is it gets more expensive. It's very time consuming, and it's just a real, just a real mess.
That's really sad. I mean, you spend your whole life building up, your own fortune, right, and looking to take care of your children and your heirs and provide them with the best possible, and to see it not happen.
Yes.
Very sad. Danny, if people are interested in finding out more about Strategic Planning Group and getting in touch with you, where can they find you?
I'm very easy to find. They could just do a Google search for Danny Umali. They could find all my information through my LinkedIn page. I do have a separate website, myspecialneedsplanner.com. But I think where the most benefit that families can get that are thinking about this type of planning is to speak with the parent mentors in their school systems, talk to families that have actually done this type of planning, so that they could help them take the mystery out of it. And, my recommendation is talk to these parent mentors, talk to family members that have done this plan, talk to somebody, just to get these conversations started and to take the mystery out of this planning, and to encourage their spouses or their other family members that this is something that definitely needs to go on their radar sooner rather than later.
If you're just tuning in, this is Elizabeth Gordon with Lee Cantor, and we're on Results Matter, a special edition of Autism Speaks. Lee, it's time for our Results Matter tip segment.
All right.
I'd like to start with Sheila Wagner from the Emory Autism Center. Sheila, what's one really valuable piece of advice that you can offer about the topic that we've been talking about this afternoon?
Well, if I can stretch that to two or three real quickly.
Please. I will give you a little leeway there.
It is definitely a developmental disorder. This is something children are born with. Some children are born with. Early intervention is crucial with this disability. And the earlier that it is recognized, the family can get support, the schools can get on board with intervention, and that child can progress and learn and decrease inappropriate behaviors and actions for appropriate behaviors. And also, if you have to look back at, I don't know how you feel about Hillary Clinton, but she did say one thing, that it takes a village to raise a child. That is absolutely true in this disability area. It takes the family, it takes the school, it takes the adult services, it takes the legal systems. It takes the coordination of everyone that will be able to come together to work and plan for this child, for the supports that are needed, and for the interventions that are going to be needed over the course of this individual's lifetime.
Excellent. Thank you. Judy Tatro with Nobis Works, why don't you kind of sum up your feelings on what results matter here?
Well, I'm going along with what Sheila said for when they get older. Don't wait till they get ready to graduate high school to start making plans and looking into things that they can proceed into. Because once they get out of school, if you don't continue that structure and that education and finding jobs for them, they fall back into a pattern, and so will the parents, of them sitting at home. And they don't want to go after that, and then it becomes a bigger fight. So definitely look into programs that they can continue on with once they're out of high school.
Wonderful. And Danny?
My tip is ask around. Find a family. Talk to your parent mentors in the school system. Find a family that's done this type of plan, and again, just take the mystery out of it. It's with the right help, it's a pretty straightforward process.
Wonderful. Well, I've certainly learned a lot.
How about you, I thought Lee? That was great. I thought all the guests did a great job, and it's an important issue, and it's something that you need to plan for, and you need to build that team of trusted advisors. It's difficult enough as it is.
Thanks, everyone, for another great show. This is Elizabeth Gordon for Lee Cantor with The Results Matter, and we will talk to you next week.
This has been a joint production of Burr and Foreman and Business Radio X. Burr and Foreman is a full-service law firm with offices across the Southeast. If results matter to you and you want them to matter to your law firm, please give Burr and Foreman a call at 404-685-4337. For more information and to find the right attorney for you, visit burr.com. That's B-U-R-R.com.